In November of 2018, San Francisco was clogged with smoke. The wildfire that caused it, as well as the devastation of other recent California wildfires that have become a regular occurrence in our state, was the inspiration for a piece published by Express Magazine during that time. The following is an excerpt from that piece.
In Paradise, it's pitch black at 9:30 in the morning. The smothering darkness is broken only by the light of the advancing flames. Terrified evacuees flee in their vehicles mere minutes after learning there was a threat. Some of them will die where they are, trapped in gridlock traffic. Others haven't even made it that far. The fire hits so fast that many people, some elderly or disabled, are trapped inside their own homes as the buildings burn down. An entire town laid to waste by the campfire. Campfire. That unfortunately innocuous moniker belies the utter devastation the fire has wrought in its 240-mile invasion. At the time this magazine is going to print, the numbers are unfathomable. 85 people dead, 14,000 homes obliterated. That's what the denizens of the Bay Area are sucking into their lungs. The microscopic floating particulates of an apocalypse diffused across hundreds of miles. The cars, the furniture, the bodies. It's a horrible thing to have interrupting your daily life, but it could be worse. There could be nothing left to interrupt.
The campfire is the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California's history. One of the latest in a string of historically deadly wildfires that have become the new norm of California's dry season. The most updated figures say that the campfire killed 86 people and caused $16.5 billion in damage. Though these numbers are big, they don't tell a full story. In Express Magazine's December issue, Boone Ashworth told the human side of that story. Talking to people who had lost their homes in the car fire, which burned through Northern California in the summer of 2018, he showed not just the hardship of losing everything you own, but the pain of having to decide what to do next. Beyond the Story is a podcast that takes a deeper look at the stories published for Express Magazine here at SF State. I'm Jacob Tucker. And today, I've invited Express Magazine's former editor-in-chief, Boone Ashworth, to delve into the stories of people who have lost everything and how wildfires have personally affected him and his family. Boone, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, how does it feel to be on the other side of being editor-in-chief?
There's a little bit less going on in my life.
A little bit less, yeah.
At the moment.
Yeah. Not staying up late into the night. In bed, copy editing stories.
Staring at stories until you go cross-eyed, yeah.
Yeah, no. Oh, well.
I miss it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess once you get used to it, then
yeah,
it's hard to go back, right?
It's fun. It's a cool publication, and I worked with great people, yourself included. And it's just nice to bring a bunch of stories together that have meaning and are fun to read.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm happy that you're able to come back on, even though you're not currently on Express Magazine. But yeah, this was a good story. You know, I wanted to cautiously congratulate you because according to an email that you got, this story won the best story for California College Media Association. I say cautiously because we won't really know for sure until the awards ceremony on March 2nd. But the email said that you won first place, right?
Yeah, and it didn't say what category, but there was only one category I entered, the school entered for me.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So, yeah, well, congratulations.
Thanks.
Yeah. So for someone who reads this story, mm-hmm. who doesn't know you, you know, they might just think it's another magazine piece written by an interested reporter. But for you, it's more than that. Tell me why you wanted to write this story.
Just to clarify a little bit. The story is going to be less about the campfire and more about some of the fires, California wildfires that preceded it. The reason being that I wrote this story right as the campfire broke out. So this was right at the very beginning of it when San Francisco was covered in all that smoke. So my experience with the fires was the car fire. That one was in Shasta County, and that took out almost 230,000 acres, a lot of that in the National Recreation Area, Whiskeytown, that's up there. but it also hit the town of Reading, Keswick, and French Gulch, and Old Shasta. And a lot of houses got burned down there. And I'm from that area. I'm from French Gulch, which is a tiny mountain town. The sign on the post office says population 325, give or take a few. So it, very small old mining town, and it's in these dry hills that get hit by wildfire kind of every summer. It's pretty much a routine to the point where people see fire on the hills across from them and just kind of go, eh, well, that's there.
Yeah.
This one, though, swept through those hills and it burned down my family's house where I used to live until I moved down to San Francisco to go to school here. So I was up there for that. I went back home when the fire broke out in San Francisco, and I was up there in Reading just sort of watching it all happen. And fire has always been something I've been interested in because I've evacuated before. You know, I grew up around it. I've seen wildfires break out, and I've seen kind of how they take communities out, or just, you know, how they affect different people. And then when it literally hit close to home for me, I wanted to write a story about it. And I wanted to write a story about fire in general. I started writing this before the campfire broke out, before we knew that it was going to be just as devastating as it was. So I talked to people who survived the Tubbs Fire in Santa Rosa, which was in October of 2017. Mm-hmm. And then I talked to people that were from Reading and Old Shasta and Keswick and French Gulch that I had some sort of connection to. I focused on there just because I knew that area better.
So French Gulch, mm-hmm. Tell me about the town. Who are the people of this community, and why would people want to live in a place that's so fire prone?
So that's the thing. So nobody has heard of this town unless you are from the area, because again, it's a small canyon town, and it's made up of, it was an old mining community. They went out there to mine gold, established a hotel and a bar, and then the town, after the gold rush, the town kind of shrank, and now the people who live out there are the people who like, who want to, live in the country. They want to have a bit of self-sufficiency. You know, it's a lot of people, they like to live in the hills, and they don't want to deal with being in the suburbs and having neighbors that are right next to them. They want to be able to have land and grow gardens of different varieties. yeah. And just kind of exist out there. A couple, somebody that I talked to for this story, Kim Jeffrey, she said that her family moved out there because they wanted to be able to teach their daughters self-sufficiency. And they're not, I feel like people who live out there, especially in Northern California, which I'm going to deviate a little bit. People don't know far Northern California. It's Trump country, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's you've got a lot of right-leaning people. It's a lot of country, a lot of farmland, a lot of people, you know, out in the woods. You don't have... People think of California, and especially San Francisco, as this liberal hub, and it's not. You go just a few hours north, and you mm-hmm. find a very different type of people.
Well, especially inland, right?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Especially off of the coast. Yeah, you know, if you get into places like Humboldt and whatnot, you're going to mm-hmm. find more of the, like, liberal, democratic, hippie types.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, when you get more inland and you get into the, kind of farmland, foresty-type areas... You get people who want to live on their own. I mean, a lot of people move out there because they don't want to have government, constantly. They don't want to have San Francisco ordinances telling them everything to do, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember a couple of years ago, I was driving through there with some friends on a road trip, and, you know, we were just listening to the radio, and every other station was like, you know, conservative talk radio.
Yeah,
like,
AM radio. Yep, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's sort of what the area is like. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a healthy democratic liberal population too. I mean, there's people
including
out,
like maybe you.
Yeah, yeah. I tend to lean that way more. Yeah, even out in the canyons in the towns like French Gulch, you know, there's a mix of people who are you know, people who are isolationists kind of want to be on their own. And mm-hmm. then people who are kind of like old school hippies that want to go out there and, you know, grow some dope and just kind of live their life and live off the land and be who they are.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of that question you asked earlier is, why would people want to live there? That's a good question. That's something that I think a lot of people who are from the city don't really get, especially because more and more people move into fire-prone areas, not just up there, but you know, the surrounding countryside in California is getting more fire-prone, just because it gets hotter for you know, whatever reason, global warming. Anyway, as the climate changes and it gets warmer and drier because there's drought, and we're going to have more and more of these fire type conditions, and it's going to be harder and harder to fight them. But at the same time, more and more people are moving out into these areas. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, there are some people who just love living out in the forest. I mean, personally, I can say that it's very peaceful. It's something that you don't get a lot here unless you go into Golden Gate Park and get away from people, which is hard to do even in Golden Gate Park. But the other side of it too is that there's a economic point to it as well. So a lot of people that I talked to for this story, and just anecdotally, they moved out there because that was where they could afford a house. The people that I talked to, Jeanette Hernandez and Doug Major, who lived in Keswick, which is this tiny town just outside of Reading, they moved out there because it was a place that they could afford, you know, and they loved it. They had trees, they had a whole big plot of land, they had, you know, a place they could call their own. And I think that as, you know, places like the Bay Area get more and more expensive, you know, you see San Francisco get crazy expensive. So people expand to the East Bay, and now that's getting crazy expensive. So you just keep expanding out. And at a certain point, people get pushed into fire-prone areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess part of this article came from a point of, or part of the reason I wrote it came from a standpoint of frustration a little bit, because I see people, you know, look at those who live in fire-prone areas and say, like, well, how could they do that? You know, why do they want to live out there? Why would you rebuild? Why not just move? For some people, it's not an option.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have, you know, if they own property out there, they don't have the means to just sell it for $1 million like you would do in the Bay Area and buy something else. Like, that's not feasible. That's not going to happen for them.
Right, right. And then the other effect of that, too, is that when natural disasters like this do happen, then the people that it affects most are those who are economically disadvantaged.
Right. Yeah. Or who don't have insurance because, you know, home insurance is expensive,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to pay for that and all of your other expenses as well. And then also places that are more and more fire prone, insurance companies are pulling out or making it more expensive to have those premiums. And it's because if it gets to the point where, you know, if people keep rebuilding their homes and forests that keep burning, like, I can see why an insurance company wouldn't want to keep giving them insurance.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, if you have a house out there and you don't have insurance and it burns down, then you just have an empty, scorched plot of land that you don't have the means to do anything with. So what are the options? I mean, yeah. I genuinely don't know. And I think that many of the people who are in this situation, whether it's in, you know, the Shasta County area or in Paradise, are asking themselves the same thing, trying to figure out where to go and what to do.
So what are some of the unforeseen difficulties that come with having all of your possessions taken in flames?
I can't answer that personally, necessarily. My family, my parents, and my brother, who lived in the house that burned, they did lose all of their possessions, and it's been interesting and weird, and I could talk about their experience. But I lost some stuff that I just had there because I said, hey, Mom and Dad, hang on to this.
mm-hmm.
But I think from the people that I talked to in this story, and one woman who lost her home in the Santa Rosa fire, Vita Iskandar, she described to me just how arduous the insurance process has been. I think that, you know, I talked about people not having insurance and how hard that is. But insurance isn't by any means a get out of pain-free card, I guess, because it, depending on your insurer and depending on how they want to treat you in the situation, it can take years to get an actual payout. And the situation that she and her partner were dealing with was that it took them a year to get just some of the basic monies. They asked for just paperwork after paperwork, proving that they had the items. You know, it's this constant back and forth, and the insurance company trying to devalue what you have. For my parents, for instance, they have to make a spreadsheet that lists every single item that was in their home. So everything that they're trying to claim, they have to write down what it is, write down how long they had it, what condition it was in, and what the replacement value is.
Yeah, geez.
So, I mean, when you think about every single thing that you have in your house, I mean, I live in a small apartment here in San Francisco, and still, I don't know that I could just list everything that I have.
Yeah. I mean, that would be time consuming, even if you had all those things still. But yeah, if you don't have them anymore and trying to just rack your memory, I can imagine.
Yeah. And it also, it forces you, I mean, you have to sit there and think, the way that my family's been doing it is going room by room and just like saying, okay, I'm going to plant myself in my imagination in the kitchen, look around. Okay, there's ladles over there. There's pots and pans over there. There's a stove here, a fridge, dishwasher. How many plates were in the cabinets? How many glasses? You know, how much food was in the pantry? Because that's the thing, too, is if you have a bunch of food at your house and then suddenly you don't have a house, you have to go and buy food and restock up. And
right.
Not to mention rebuy all your silverware and all of your plates and everything else. But it's genuinely really hard to think of everything that you lost. I mean, if you have an attic and you have stuff that's in the attic or in a basement or whatever, like you put things there for storage and you use them once a year or whatever, how many Christmas decorations did you have? Do you want to get those replaced? Well, the insurance company can do that if you can remember everything and write it all down and value it and say how long you had it. Another thing it kind of forces you to do is keep dwelling on the situation, because if you constantly have to go back and think about, okay, this is where I had this, you're thinking about your house, you're thinking about your place, you're thinking about the way things used to be as you're trying to get money to replace all of that, but you just keep putting yourself back in that situation, and it's kind of detrimental to your mental health to keep thinking about it. You know, it's nice to be able to move on, but it doesn't happen quickly. It doesn't happen within, you know, 6 or 7 months, however it's long it's been since we've lost the place. And it's taken, you know, 1 to 2 years for other people too, at least a year for Vita. I mean, it's a long drawn out process,
right?
Pretty much on from the physical to the emotional level.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not just the stress too, but you know, it's like, you know, we like to talk about how things around us are just things, but when it comes to your house and your possessions, things that you've had for years, the place that you've lived and grown and raised a family, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, it's weird. There's certain things that start to annoy you when you've been through it. The phrase people talk about, oh, it's just stuff. I saw the campfire was going on, and then there was the Woolsey fire going on in Southern California. And I saw people on TV, fire officials, saying it's just stuff, get out, you know, get out alive. And absolutely, they're right. But at the same time, sure, there's all the memories attached to it. But for me, the way that statement kind of becomes problematic is if you think about, you know, the people who don't have insurance, who don't have the means to replace that stuff. It's not just stuff if you lose your stove and your wash machine and you cannot get the money to get a new one. That's not just stuff that changes how you have to live your life. I mean, one, you don't have a house, and then two, you have to figure out how to piece things back together, and it's not easy, that's for sure.
You talked to a lot of different people in this story. Mm-hmm. And what were some of the different reactions to the tragedy that you found? Because they were varying.
Yeah, yeah. People, you know, people process trauma or catastrophe differently. Overall, I saw a lot of positivity. And I've seen that with my own family and the friends that I have who lost places. And then also the sources that I reached out to for this story. There's been a lot of people who are grateful that they've essentially made it out with their life, I guess. Because while I was doing this story, you know, the campfire had just started. And so I was interviewing people from the car fire as the numbers kept growing in the campfire, as the fatalities went up and the homes destroyed went up and up. Mm-hmm. And so the people who had been through this, you know, just a few months before or even a year before in the case of the Tubbs fire, sort of looked at the campfire and felt compassion for them, felt so sorry for the people that were going through something that they'd been through, that I heard a lot of people being like, oh, well, yes, I lost everything and had to live out of a tent and, you know, just now got a motorhome and don't have any food in the cupboards, but at least I'm not in paradise, you know. And that's, I think it says a lot about humanity that people, even who are down on the bottom rung, even after they've lost everything and don't have the means to replace it, that they still feel sorry for others, that they still feel like they are more fortunate than other people. I mean, you know, it's, I didn't talk to a single person who was wallowing in despair, you know, who thought, well, this is the end, like that I've hit rock bottom. I'm just, nobody was giving up. They wanted to fight and wanted to make their, rebuild their communities and then also help the people who are still being affected by it.
Well, you talked to someone who had lost their home in the Tubbs fire, mm-hmm. who was making an effort to help the people who had lost their homes in the recent fire, right?
Yeah, yeah. Vita Iskander, she, Vita's amazing. She started a website called Neighbors Together Strong and Resilient. And it was designed to help survivors of the Tubbs fire because there was a lot of them. And so she started posting resources on there. General information, things like what to do when a fire happens, you know, not even to prepare, but how to evacuate, how to kind of process the mental trauma that you've been through, and then perhaps most importantly, how to deal with the insurance. So a lot of what they focused on was sort of breaking down different insurance companies' policies into simple English, telling people what was expected of them, you know, what their rights were, how they could sort of be better equipped to talk to the insurance companies and not be forced to jump through too many hoops. And she had been doing that for a year at that point, before the campfire happened, and just channeling all of that energy into helping other people get through the process. I should mention Vita lost her home in the fire. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I mentioned that at the top, but that's part of going back to what I said before. It's like the same sort of generosity and compassion. You know, somebody who lost their home in the fire, the way that you process it is by going and starting a website to help other people process what they've been through.
Yeah.
And I find that very inspiring. Mm-hmm. So
I mean, the other thing too here is that when you lose your house in a fire, you have a decision to make. You have to either rebuild, you know, that same plot of land that you still own, or you got to start over somewhere else. And you met people who, you know, answered that question differently, depending on their circumstances, right?
Yeah, yeah, very much so. I mean, depends on if you... I can't even say like it depends on specific factors. It's very much up to the person, and I don't know that it's ever an easy decision. One of the fire survivors who asked that her name not be used in the story compared it to making a major medical decision, and she said that paraphrasing, but she said, let's say you have cancer, and you have to opt between chemo or surgery. There's not really a best option. Like, not one or the other is 100% effective. And so there's a chance that you pick one route and you wish that you had gone the other way for whatever reason. And so there's all, no matter which option you choose, you're going to have doubts about the other one. And so it's hard to make that choice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's people, I didn't actually quote in the story, but who had lived in their home for 30 years. They built their house 30 years ago.
Wow.
And had lived there for that long, and then, you know, survived multiple fires that came through and just went around them. And then this one finally took them out, and they're going back and they're going to rebuild because they love the area and they, you know, have been there that long. At the same time, you have people, like I talked to Mike and Teresa Powell, who lived in Reading, just outside of Old Shasta. And they lost their place and they decided to move to Oregon after they got insurance money. And the reason was this, they kind of had always wanted to do that, wanted to get out of Reading. They liked the coastal environment more. And so this was an opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. My own family, they haven't started to rebuild. I don't know if they're going to, but my parents are traveling. They have a travel trailer thing that they pull tow behind the truck that they were able to get with the insurance money. And I know they have always talked about wanting to do that, travel around the country. And in a way, they feel guilty because they're able to do it now.
Yeah.
And so they feel, you know, they say if the house hadn't burned down, they would have never gotten an insurance payout and been able to, you know, get a trailer to be able to drive around in. And so they feel bad for taking advantage of the situation almost. I mean, even though objectively you can look at it and say, well, you didn't cause the fire, so it's not like you should feel guilty about it.
But I mean, it's, I guess it's understandable in that, you know, what they're doing is they're treating it as an opportunity, right? Rather than just as a tragedy, which it is.
Right. You know? And same thing with Mike and Teresa Powell. They're treating it as an opportunity. And I think that it's a luxury to be able to do that. It's, in a way, people like my parents are the lucky ones because they are able to move on and not have to make the decision if they're going to rebuild or what right now because they had insurance and so they were able to be taken care of. And yeah, it's... it's kind of a luxury to be able to afford that. And it's a privilege, you know. Obviously, it's not ideal. It's not how they would have wanted to, oh, now we're going to travel the country. Not like,
right.
They would have preferred to go a different route. To
save it and then it later. You know, and
wait a couple years and save some money maybe. Most people don't want their house to burn down for the insurance money. I mean, every now and then. But
yeah.
No, it's just... It's very different. And the thing is, it's very different whether you had insurance or you didn't have insurance or even what type of insurance you had. Because, you know, some people are able to get an insurance payout and then move on and move somewhere else. And then some people are still making spreadsheets and still trying to find documents to verify that they own certain things. And it's just a... you know, it's still a convoluted process and it's not, nobody's 100% A-okay after it.
Right.
But, you know, the house burns down and then suddenly you, if you're lucky, you have somewhere to go. We stayed with family. And then you think, oh, well, I didn't save my toothbrush because that wasn't a priority. So then you have to buy your toothbrush and you got to buy toothpaste and then you have to buy shampoo and get all this stuff. And then theoretically, yeah, it's stuff you would have bought anyway, but you're buying it to replace what you lost. And so you can get, I mean, if you have the right insurance, you can get reimbursed for that. But it's keeping track of everything and then proving it with receipts. It's just, it's a long, drawn-out process. I mean, it's why you see in Santa Rosa that very few, I think fewer than half of the homes that were in Santa Rosa are in the process of being, that were lost in the Tubbs fire, are in the process of being rebuilt. Because it's just such a time-consuming process to get anywhere, to make any sort of progress. I mean, There are people who are rebuilding in Reading. I've talked to a couple people there too, and they're anxious to get back into it and rebuild their house and, you know, live normally again, but it's not gonna be anytime soon.
Yeah. Takes time.
And even if it is, then you have all these trees that were around you that, you know, 50-year-old trees that are gone. And so you're not gonna have the vegetation. Like, things are gonna be very different, and it just, yeah, the time to heal from it is decades, theoretically. Right. I mean, even if you get your house built within 2 years, then, you know, before you can have everything back to normal, it's going to be a long time.
Yeah. And the new normal is not going to be the same as the old normal.
Yeah. And that's what worries me. You know, I can't sit here and say, oh, fires are going to get worse, because, you know, I don't know that. I can't predict the future, but there's clearly a trend. Fires have been getting way more exacerbated than they have in the past. We're seeing a lot more of them. We're seeing them destroy hundreds of thousands of acres and thousands of buildings. And I don't think it's going away. I worry for next fire season and what is going to come next. And I hope that people can prepare and take it seriously and look at where they live and look at the possibility of a fire coming through and plan accordingly for if something like that happens.
So in writing this story and in the experience, you know, with your family losing their house, did you learn anything about how human beings react to tragedy?
I think what I learned about people going through tragedy is something that's going to sound fairly obvious, and it's that people are a lot more positive than you think. People are, they want to help each other. They want to kind of rebuild the community. It's been how many months since July was when the car fire broke out, and we're recording this in February. And I still see people working together, you know, whenever I go back up to the Reading area. When the fire was happening, we were in a Safeway or something like that, and one of the employees was walking around with just a tray of cookies, just like handing them to people, and people were just taking cookies. And you still see that, maybe not the cookie thing, but metaphorically, you still see people getting along, well, you know, wanting to help each other. But at the same time, it's hard, and that takes its toll. And then you see things happening with insurance claims and people trying to get their houses rebuilt and get their lives back together, and it takes forever, and that can be frustrating. And so at a certain point, you know, there's all this compassion and goodwill, but there's real frustration and kind of lingering chaos still. That it's a bizarre mix. It's a bizarre mix of insanity and human goodness, I suppose.
Well, Boone, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This was nice.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. To read Boone's story and other fantastic feature pieces written by the Express Magazine staff, visit our website at expressmagazine.org. That's expressmagazine.org. We've got a lot of great new content coming soon, and if you want to keep updated, you can also follow us on Instagram at Express Magazine. This has been Jacob Tucker. I hope you have a wonderful day.